some bacteria make other bacteria more tolerant, less susceptible to antimicrobials. We also know the opposite. We don't know why yet. So that means if we can find the right combinations, for instance, if we know to find a particular microbe, which would make, for instance, E. coli more susceptible to a particular antibiotic, that will make that antibiotic much more potent. And if we already know that that microbe may potentially be present actually already in the urobiome, often be present in the urobiome, then prebiotics may be, well, potentially suitable.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization, also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. This episode is part of our podcast series on leveraging microbial ecology for health. In this series, we speak with experts about shaping microbial ecosystems using various tools, including biotics, to create positive effects on health.
Hi, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And today's guest on the podcast is Marion de Vos. And Marion is an assistant professor at the University of Groningen in the north of Holland, a place I have a real fondness for because I spent a year of my PhD working in Groningen. And I see you describe, Marion, as being interested in microbial ecology and evolution, particularly with a perspective on antimicrobial resistance. But it's the first time I think I've seen this term eco-evolutionary. Can you explain how you got into this field and what you mean by eco-evolutionary approach?
Yes. All right. Well, thanks for the introduction and thanks for having me speak on the podcast here. I'm very happy to be here. So eco-evolutionary basically means how ecology, how microbial interactions in this case, and evolution interact. Of course, we know that for microbes, these skills overlap. So ecology and evolution are really overlapping skills, and this is what really fascinates me. While I was doing my postdoc in the laboratory of Tobias Bollenbach, then at IST Austria, we actually started to look into this fascinating model system of urinary tract infections. By then, we actually knew, or hardly knew actually, about the presence of the urobiome. Then it only started to emerge that polymicrobial interactions may actually be playing a role in urinary tract infections. And obviously, urinary tract infections are treated with antimicrobials. So at that moment, we mostly started to look at ecological interactions. So are there any interactions? Do these particular bacteria have an effect on each other's growth? And indeed, we found that particular species which were present and which were identified and isolated from urinary tract infections indeed have an effect on each other's growth. But we also recognized that they had an effect on the, you could say, the ecological sensitivity to antimicrobials. And then, since I actually did my PhD on evolution, I realized, wait a second. So in that case, it may actually well be that these microbial interactions, they're driving potentially, they're mediating the evolutionary potential. So if you would treat in a test tube, if you would treat a test tube of, let's say, E. coli, with a particular antibiotic and another bacterium is having an effect on the growth of that E. coli, for instance, then that may change population sizes, that may change mutation rates, and in that way, it can actually speed up or slow down the evolution of antimicrobial resistance by these ecological microbial interactions.
So let me take you back through some of that then. When you talk about the urobiome, are you talking about a bladder microbiome, a urethral microbiome?
Yes.
What part of the urogenital tract are you talking about?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Yes, this is also always a discussion. What part are we actually talking about? Well, colloquially, I say the bladder microbiome, but of course, actually, it's the urethra and the bladder, right? So because at least in our lab, this is also for people who are aware of urinary tract infections. So let me take one step back from that question. When people are treated or when people are recognized to have a urinary tract infection, women know very well you have to pee in a little tube and in a bottle, and you have to have the midstream catch, which means you don't have the first, well, ideally, you don't take the first bacteria that come from the urethra, but you first flush your urethra with urine. And then you collect that midstream catch. And that is supposed to have mostly microbes from the bladder. Of course, we all know about biome fails. We know all about attachment. So it's of course, it's a mixed bag. And of course, it's likely also a gradient between of these. So in that sense, I think the Eurobiome is actually a collection of both of these.
And I'm familiar with the kind of bugs that occupy the gut, obviously lots of strict anaerobes. And what kind of bacteria are in the Eurobiome? Does that shift more towards gram-negatives, facultative anaerobes, still anaerobes? What's in there?
Yes, what's in there? Exactly. Yeah. So this is a question which is now being elucidated also by bladder punctures. So it's not only people not only doing midstream cats, but also real bladder extraction. So we really know which bacteria also in the bladder to make that case. So we know, for instance, in case of an infection, the paradigm is that often these are caused by E. coli. So often when they're in a case of infection, E. coli is also there. But also we know now that also when there is no infection, sometimes E. coli can also be there, but then often in lower numbers. Then the gram-negatives have actually mostly been overlooked, such as we know that enterococci play a role, enterococci, Enterococcus faecalis, Enterococcus faecium, which is, of course, very interesting for the probiotics people. I hope we will come back on that later. Also, staphylococci, we find Gardnerella species and lactobacilli are present. Prevotella, Streptococcus. So it's really a mixed bag, actually. And sometimes it's also really a mixed bag between gram-positives and gram-negatives, which are present. But in the absence of infection, and I have the idea that it's mostly actually the gram-positives are more abundant than the gram-negative.
So obviously, the male and female urogenitory tracts are anatomically very different. Are the microbiomes yes. also very different?
Yes, yes. So this question is now starting to be elucidated. And yes, there are slightly differences. And I have to say, I'm not an expert on the exact differences. So I'm a little scary to answer that. But I do know that in urinary tract infections, there are in male patients, they're more often caused by the gram-positives instead of the gram-negatives. Also, gram-negatives are also involved, but it's more, let me put it, recognize that also there, the gram-positives play a role. Yeah, and indeed, this length definitely makes a big difference. Yes. Yeah.
Well, since we're talking about the differences between the host, between the male and the female, can you talk to us about the importance of the ecological perspective in how a perturbation like an antibiotic will create pressure for antibiotic resistance and the interactions between the host and the microbes and also among the microbes?
Yeah, sure. Of course. Yes, of course. So, let me say, can take a step back again from that, because often when people are treated, women have urinary tract infections, when they go to the GP, the urine tester, to see whether they actually have a urinary tract infection, then often either you get a dipstick test or urine is cultured. But then when urine is actually cultured, those culture media, they're mainly developed for the gram negatives. So this is also what is screened for. It is also the bugs that are actually recognized to cause these infections. So this is one thing. So often when women go to the GP, they're treated for these gram negatives if they're in high abundance. And then what we find actually is that we have a large longitudinal cohort, is that when these women are treated, we often find that indeed that a particular part of the bacteria actually goes down, often the gram negatives, which were a little more abundant. But then often this is followed by a potential, regrowth of other bacteria, which are also there. So this is something. And then for the development, so this is within the host. And then we take it out of the host and in a test tube. And then if we look at these ecological interactions in those test tubes, so where we have performed these eco-evolutionary antimicrobial resistance experiments, and then we see that, now I'm coming back to Enterococcus, is that when we investigate the speed of resistance development, of antimicrobial resistance evolution of E. coli, in the presence of Enterococcus, then we actually see that the presence of Enterococcus speeds up the rate of evolution, of antimicrobial resistance evolution. So this is really, somehow there is an interaction between E. coli and Enterococcus that makes somehow the population sizes of E. coli a little tiny bit larger. It also makes them faster resistant to antimicrobials. So this is one way. So this is via really point mutations in the genome. People say, well, you know, in real life, we know that plasmids are much more important. So we also investigated these eco-evolutionary interactions by means of horizontal gene transfer. And then we also, again, we use this urinary medium in which we really mimic the conditions in urine. I'm not going to say in the bladder because we don't have mucins and all these, we don't have a bladder wall and all these things. So if we take it with a test tube, a urine medium, and we combine E. coli and again Enterococcus, we can see that also the rate of horizontal gene transfer from E. coli to another uropathogenic E. coli of a plasmid that contains antimicrobials is really sped up in the presence of Enterococcus. And even though they have a tiny, tiny population size, they have 10 to the third CFU per ml present, while E. coli maybe has 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8, still they have that effect. So to me, this is a very striking example of an eco-evolutionary interaction that is happening, and it has an effect on the development of antimicrobial resistance.
And you mentioned, Miranda, and we know that antibiotic resistance can happen as a result of point mutations in genes that render the cell insensitive to the antibiotic, or the acquisition of genes that are kind of dedicated to either destroying the antibiotic or pumping it away from the cell or something like that. You mentioned that both can be seen in your models. Do you think evolution acts differently on these different types of these different origins of antimicrobial resistance? Or is it more just the phenotype that is what evolution acts on?
Well, this is a very philosophical question. So in a sense, evolution acts on the phenotype, right? But the mechanism of how it is brought about is important in the evolutionary process itself. So what I'm finding interesting is that actually that while the mechanisms are so different for the acquisition for antimicrobials via plasmid or via point mutations, as entirely different mechanisms, we don't have, for instance, any growth differences that we see in this point mutation experiment. And yet, still the same same ecological factors play the same role. This is a very applied answer to your question, but if you look more at the abstract way, how actually even how evolution occurs, and I really think it really matters, of course, whether it's via horizontal gene transfer or whether it's actually via point mutations, because then other processes play a role as well. For instance, also the presence or that the abundance of other microbes. So for instance, other studies of other people in the field have shown that while there is abundant horizontal gene transfer also in the gut, it really also depends on the high enough presence of other microbes to which these plasmids can be transferred. So there are also dilution effects that can potentially play a role, which is, of course, different for plasmid transfer than for point mutations.
What do you think are the main mechanisms of HGT in the bladder or in any community? Do you think, I mean, you wouldn't have phage in your system, I presume, but there still could be lysogenic phage.
Yes.
Then
yes.
There would be transformation, conjugation.
Yes.
Which do you think are the important mechanisms?
Yeah, so indeed we have indeed lysogenic phage. They are playing a role. We try to not look at them, but they are there. And they actually also, we believe playing a role in those evolution experiments because we see that they are targeted. But we know that transformation, I don't know. Conjugation, yes, we have at least shown that in this urinary environment, yes, conjugation is quite fast even in these harsh environments. So yes, that likely plays a role. And we know that plasmids are available. So I assume that definitely plays a role. And then also in another study, we've also seen that it's not only the plasmid in itself, which is either there or it's a horizontal, the plasmid itself with a gene or a point mutation in this particular gene, which brings about antimicrobial resistance. But we also see that gene amplifications within a plasmid can also play a role. So to my opinion, it's really a mixed bag. So I really think actually that all processes are playing a role potentially. And of course, it's a question for urinary tract infections specifically, and I think for other infections as well. Is it mainly that development of antimicrobial resistance evolution is occurring in that particular infection, or is it actually occurring elsewhere, for instance, in the gut? But that is still an open question, I believe. Yeah.
Can you talk to us about how the microbes sort of may be benefiting one another in mounting a defense against the antimicrobials?
Yes, exactly. So on one hand, we know that particular microbes, they become less tolerant to antimicrobials. So they become more tolerant, less susceptible. And we know from a study that I'm actually writing up now, that there are metabolites that actually have an effect on efflux pumps. So basically, there are interspecies signaling that leads to that effect. We also know that it's also somehow mediated potentially just by crossfeeding and having a larger population size, because we know that larger population sizes are also, well, less sensitive to antimicrobials. So this is called the inoculum effect, which actually people know also in the clinic, is that if you don't always use the same standard concentration of microbes in your MIC, the minimal inhibitory concentration experiments, that will actually also affect how the resistance to bacteria is seen. So we know on one hand, we expect interspecies signaling. On the other hand, we also expect that bacteria can crossfeed on each other, that they can benefit from, one microbe can benefit from the waste products of the other. That leads to an increased population size, and that then likely has an effect on the inoculum effect. Then there is this third factor, which is also that microbes, for instance, Proteus, it changes the pH, and antimicrobials are less effective under potentially high pH, for instance. And these pH effects then also have an effect on the efficacy of antimicrobials.
Obviously, ISAP and, you know, our interest in science behind prebiotics and probiotics, I can't immediately bring to mind any possible application for prebiotics in the eurobiome. I don't know how you deliver them, but probiotics. Do you think there's any role for probiotics in controlling urodental infections? And would they be delivered orally or vaginally, or how do you think they'd be administered?
Yeah. So this is always a tricky question, eh? So I think prebiotics, actually potentially, and probiotics as well. So let me first say why. Because some bacteria make other bacteria more tolerant, less susceptible to antimicrobials. We also know the opposite. Right. We don't know why yet. So that means if we can find the right combinations, for instance, if we know to find a particular microbe which would make, for instance, E. coli more susceptible to a particular antibiotic, that will make that antibiotic much more potent. And if we already know that that microbe may potentially be present actually already in the urobiome, often be present in the urobiome, then prebiotics may be, well, potentially suitable. Of course, it's always the question how to apply that. That's always tricky. The same counts for probiotics, of course. We all know that, at least in the case of urinary tract infections, the infection goes from the back to the front. This is also why women have to wipe from the front to the back. So changing the gut microbiome may have an effect on the abundance of potential uropathogenic E. coli that could lead to an infection. This is one way. This is, I think multiple probiotic companies are going in that direction. But ideally, of course, and this is what I would be in favor of, is that actually finding a way to really disturb this urobiome itself. And then actually by toppling that ecosystem, then actually make the ecosystem, the microbial ecosystem, less friendly for infections. And then also, of course, we talk here about the paradigm of EPEC, uropathogenic E. coli. We also know, we believe that actually urinary tract infections can also be a dysbiosis. So it's not only an invasion of a EPEC in a dysbiotic microbiome, but potentially also that maybe the overgrowth of other species, or actually the particular consistency of that ecological community, will lead to an infection. And then if we know these things better, then I think I can also answer your question better. What would be the best way? Should we go for prebiotics or for probiotics? But I think there is potentially a lot. There is a lot of potential.
Can you talk to us about the kind of techniques you use? I'm impressed by how you do. You use mathematical modeling, but you also do a lot of things in the laboratory. And
yes.
Interested in your thoughts as an educator, how your own career developed and what advice you'd give to other, you know, microbiologists.
Yeah. Okay. First, I would like to acknowledge all the real modelers which have been involved in all my projects. So I would like to say I'm a real biologist, turned microbiologist, turned trained biophysicist. So it's a mixed bag, but I'm at heart a biologist. So I don't do full modeling. I think what our lab is, the niche of our lab is actually doing experiments in such a way that they can be used for modeling. And in that way, you can actually get much more out of the data, I believe. Because then if you describe, in our case, the ecological or the evolutionary interactions a little bit more abstract level, then basically you can just apply eco-evolutionary models to them. And that can then help you understand whether an ecosystem is, for instance, stable, whether there's potential for a stable ecosystem in the urinary tract, or whether it's not a stable ecosystem, or what particular factors are most important for the transfer of this ecological transfer of horizontal gene, for the ecological interactions in horizontal gene transfer, or maybe we could apply that using prebiotics or probiotics. So my suggestion is try to find the empty spaces. What I feel is that we're in somehow in a particular niche that really connects the, on the one hand, we talk to people in the clinic. We have collaborations with people in the clinic. We use the knowledge in the clinic. We regularly have discussion with people in the clinic. Then we take those microbes in and make sure that we actually use the as relevant as possible conditions that can be mimicked in the lab, but can also be, well, applied in our lab. And then we also talk together also with the theoretical biologists and with the biophysicists to actually try to see whether we can actually get that, well, puzzle, whether we can solve that puzzle all together. So while I don't have a clear advice, I would say follow your heart and try to find those empty niches, because there are still quite a few. Yeah.
Yes.
And Marian, the antibiotic resistance, of course, generally, at least the dogma would be that it makes treating the disease more difficult. But do you think that the emergence of antibiotic-resistant pathogens in the urobiome actually makes the likelihood of disease even beginning in the first place more likely? I mean, do you think antibiotic resistance is linked in any way to virulence and likelihood of disease developing, or it simply is a barrier to treating disease once it's happened?
Yes, so I think so. In one way, yes, definitely. We know also that if bacteria become more stressed, that also that stress responses often lead to increased efflux. Well, we already talked about efflux, but also leads to increased virulence, right? So if you think about it from an evolutionary perspective, higher doses hitting an infection with a high dose means that you actually limit the growth. And by limiting the growth, you potentially force those microbes to behave differently. Well, to look for it, of course, is anthropogenic view, but to look for other opportunities. So potentially, if you hit them harder, they grow slower, but maybe that actually allows them to attach better. Maybe there's more biofilm formation potentially. Alternatively, also, when you treat them with high dose of antimicrobials, you also change that ecosystem in the bladder. And maybe also that, you know, it's like weeding your garden, right? So basically, so my neighbor, she just had somebody weed her entire garden. But now I know what's going to happen in the next 2 months. There's going to be lots of weeds, right? But yeah. While my garden, it may not look as smooth now, but actually there are lots of small plants actually growing there. That means that actually the weeds that I don't want in my garden, they actually don't have any room to actually live there. And I think this is also potentially also the case with urinary tract infection. So over-treatment potentially topples the ecosystem in a lot of states, which potentially also promotes disease.
How do you think this, I mean, I'm looking towards the future now, and, you know, we're living in the era of One Health.
Yeah.
And antibiotics, we seem to be exhausting them and using them up. Do you think the antibiotics ship has sailed, or we need to develop new antibiotics, or we need to come up with completely different mechanisms? And how does that all fit into One Health philosophy that you espouse?
Yeah, so I think first, antibiotics are very good at treating infections. So we should actually keep them for when we really want to and need to treat an infection. So this is really stewardship, right? So basically, I think everybody knows that and most people are acting on it. Some people are not. I think everybody should act on it because it really keep it. This is very important. Then from the still stay a little bit in the clinical realm of the One Health. Then I also believe, you already mentioned it, prebiotics, probiotics, I think they can definitely play a role in either toppling the ecosystem, having favorable strains established, or make sure that other isolates cannot establish or actually compete potentially even with pathogens. That's one thing. So I think there's definitely a role also for that industry. Of course, probiotics, food safety, treatments, that's another direction. So that's a clinical pipeline. So I think we need to develop that clinical pipeline much better. Then from the One Health perspective and antimicrobial resistance, of course, this is a big issue. And especially, I think in the Netherlands, we're doing quite well. I think in other parts of the world, I think maybe not. And of course, it's always this balance with the presence of antimicrobials and which are there to treat patients. and the overuse often in agriculture. So I think, of course, the over-exploitation, overuse of antimicrobials in the over-exploitation of agriculture, I think this is a big no-go. I think, honestly, that ship has sailed. I'm not entirely sure whether the agronomical companies agree with me, but I think that should shift. We should actually look at the worldview from an eco-evolutionary perspective. Then, of course, antimicrobials in the environment, this is an issue. But we can also do something about this. For instance, we can do something, we can treat potentially manure. We have potentially, we can place fermenters, such that actually this is not such a big problem. And we can actually have those waste products actually not go to our lands and not go in our water. So I think there are already solutions available to us, but we should actually use them and we should make them a priority. So that also in the future, we can safeguard the real use of antimicrobials. And then, of course, the question is, is the emergence of antimicrobials? This is mainly happening in humans and their livestock, right? So this is also what we should really limit. So coming back, I think on one hand, it's really stewardship, limiting the really strong selection of antimicrobial resistance, but also working downstream to make sure that they don't spread further in the ecosystem.
That's a really positive note on which to finish. I think laying out a kind of a path towards much better management of our antimicrobial resources. So, Marion, thank you so much for joining us. And thank your daughter, please, who was absolutely impeccably behaved in the background there as we were recording. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you much for having me.
Thanks, Marion.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. If you've been enjoying the show, please follow and rate our podcast to help support our continued work. You can also send us your feedback, questions or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org and check the show notes for links and further information on this topic.